the second place, I was very enthusiastic about the analysis of Ian Thomas, and I recognized a lot of it. To my mind came a new swimming pool, which we had, which we opened a year after I became mayor of Amsterdam, and we had to close it 3 months later because of the crime which was there. And it was, this was a result of the fact that at the designing of during the designing of the swimming pool, there was not paid enough attention to the possibility of crimes, which was especially well in the western part of Amsterdam, of which I spoke yesterday, which was there. And there was too many entrances in the building. There were too many hiding places. So there you see. Well, in fact, the same kind of analysis was which was here. Well, the difference is that the, here we were speaking of an area which exists already for a longer time, and this was a new swimming pool. So this stresses the point of Ian, how important it is to look very carefully after the possibilities of crime, and I think it's very useful to introduce here, speaking about urban planning, of the introduction of the analysis of the police force. So in the second place, well, but that's, that, I think everybody will think that that is absolutely true. Prevention is much cheaper than repression. And if there is not enough money for prevention, then I think in the end that is penny wise and pound foolish. And yes, rehabilitation takes more than 4 years. Well, that's a fact, and I think that politicians, of course, they have a term of 4 years, but nevertheless, they should be at least interested in the amelioration of the area, because of the fact that otherwise they are pound foolish.
Thank you very much indeed, Job, and. Our next respondent is Richard Sennett from the London School of Economics and MIT, sorry.
I wanted to raise with Ian Thomas two issues that we struggled with in New York about designing places that diminish the possibilities of crime. And these had to do, one of them you invoked, which is the notion of defensible space. And the other was a program inspired by Jane Jacobs called Eyes on the Street. I'll describe them very briefly to you. New York City had made a disastrous commitment to housing poor people in elevator-serviced apartment buildings with nice lawns around them. And the more of these structures they built, the more crime friendly the architecture became. In the 80s, following a lead from Jane Jacobs, we tried, first of all, to reduce, obviously, the height so that no public housing would be serviced by elevators. And second, and more importantly, we tried to restore the street wall so that anybody from looking out from an apartment could see what was happening on the street. That is, we got rid of all setbacks. And this proved somewhat successful. It's not a cause and effect, as you know, but I mean, the principle of it was that what you call natural surveillance was the most important thing we could do in poor areas. We don't have CCTV cameras. It's not something we have as a technology very well developed. But this natural surveillance of moving the buildings forward and lowering them seemed to have a real effect on what was going on in the street. On the defensible space issue, we made an error. And the error was to put up more and more fences around the backyards of buildings and in between buildings. And we found the wall, a classic architectural element of defense, we found that actually the more chain link fences we put up, the more crime zones we created. So at the end of the 80s, we began at great expense to undo the error we had made. And to make the physical boundaries between buildings unwalled. We took down brick walls, anything, to take away the notion that there was some place where you could be seen or not got at. So that the space became more defensible by becoming more open. And I wonder if these resonate to you as ways of dealing with security and space in London. No, we're designers, you know. But I wonder if these also are kinds of issues where security and space meet for you in London as well.
Thank you, Richard. In fact, although I think it would be a good thing if I give you an opportunity to respond immediately to that precise question, and indeed anything Job said, because although we didn't see on Fred's one picture the properties, certainly the social housing at the Elephant, it had an ominous similarity with what you were describing, Richard. So, Ian, do respond.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree totally, I think, with all of that. Again, whilst we're just starting to make changes, certainly in Southwark at the moment, if you look at Peckham, again, which is not too far south of the Elephant and Castle, where an eight-year-old was murdered about five or six years ago, Damilola Taylor, on the North Peckham estate. That's exactly what's been done there, that the majority of the high-rise housing has been taken down, that the spaces have been opened up. Again, exactly the sorts of things you're talking about, which, again, from a layman's terms, it would appear to me to be very effective.
Okay, thank you very much. And our third respondent, this is, of course, won't mean others can't respond to these points as we move on. Enrique Penalosa, who has spoken earlier, is previously the mayor of Bogota. Enrique.
Thank you. Well, I don't know anything either about Elephant and Castle, and I could not make a very intelligent comments, but I would like to try to relate some of these things that I perceive. I think one of the themes underlying the discussion is whether a massive regeneration is convenient or whether, as it seemed to be suggested by Ian Thomas, you would have to generate a project that would serve as a catalyst that would spread to the whole borough. In fact, it seems that the theme along this talk is the importance of public pedestrian space. And maybe if we could create great public pedestrian space, how could this stimulate safety? How could this stimulate regeneration, spontaneous regeneration, improvement of the area? For example, when Fred Manson made the presentation, he said that when the neighbors were asked about the Tate Museum, that the thing that they most emphasize is that they wanted a park. And then all the talk of Ian Thomas is a persistent emphasis in the problem of public space and crime, and how certain type of public space generates criminality. And I don't think it's only because it creates dark environments where people are more easily mocked, but I think because if you generate an environment which does not show respect for human dignity, the whole social organization, the state, does not have enough legitimacy, and so people do not obey the law, and people do not denounce those who break the law, and people do not identify with the social organization. So I think, for example, in Bogota, we were extremely successful, almost inadvertently, in dropping the murder rate from like 87 per 100,000 to 23 per 100,000 in a matter of 7 years or so. And I think it's very difficult to understand exactly what the cause is, but I think it has to do not just I mean, the public space effect is not just that you create spaces where it's more difficult to mock someone, but it's because you create a whole new sense of dignity and belonging and legitimacy to the social organization. Again, Peter Bishop in the last talk had talked about how are streets going to be. So I think that's a big question. I think we cannot do with urban policy, urban design to solve the problems of poverty or disadvantage or unemployment, but it can certainly help to create inclusion and to dignify life. We cannot give people high quality, the low-income people cannot have high quality consumer goods, but they can certainly consume high quality pedestrian space. It was also said in last talk that BBC building did not have an impact in the White City area. And it seems to me it's basically because it had no new creation of public pedestrian space around it. It's just an isolated building, of course, where some people from elsewhere come and walk to and work. It doesn't create anything, but it would be very different. I certainly believe that a radical improvement in public pedestrian spaces in an area maybe can completely change the attitude and itself can be a very powerful catalyst for self-regeneration.
Thank you, Enrique. I mean, I think your question about the dehumanizing nature of that environment is absolutely appropriate for the Elephant and Castle. I don't know if either Ian or Fred would like to say anything about that. I mean, it was an open invitation for people in many ways to behave and live badly. Fred?
We would call this a regeneration scheme. It was done in the 60s, but it was someone who had a conscientious desire to change the city. They got the priorities different than what we have. But when it opened, people were actually quite proud of it as a new shopping center in London. When the Haygate opened, people were very proud of that. And by the way, the housing that was replaced by the Haygate was really rather dreadful. It was big blocks. I think they were either Guinness or Peabody Estate, very close together. So that I think my reaction is that we are not very good at predicting the people's reactions to the things we do. And that I don't think anyone who was part of doing this project was malicious in what they were doing. I'll just mention one other thing. When I first came to Southwark, I had a session with these people in the architects department who had actually built these projects. And the architect for the Haygate simply could not understand why it did not work. And he went through with a complete rational explanation for every action he took without ever standing back and looking at it as we do now to say, this isn't going to work.
Okay, and is your point directly related to this? Is this a directly? Yes. Try it briefly. I'll come back to them. This is a directly related point.
When we are talking about safety, and then we are always looking for additional technical support, and then we are talking about a huge amount of people which are living around here. All of the people have eyes, all of the people have ears, and they are closed because the public space is deteriorated by cars. There is noise, and there's air pollution, and what is happening, the people are closed off from public space, so you have no control over the public space. What Enrique has said just before, if you open the windows, you can control the public space. Somebody cries, and you know this is the best camera you can have, and the best audio system. And this is crazy what is happening here, to let the quality of public space deteriorate for the minority of some, Flintstone behaviors.
Though not unique. Rem Koolhaas, you're next in line.
I have a question, kind of a general question, whether talking about the ubiquity of CCTV as you have, the apparent desirability of it and the comprehensiveness of it really seems to all of us a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, personally, I find it a rather frightening condition. Living in London, it actually makes me feel unfree at certain moments in a very noticeable way. And I have a question to you. Did you reduce the crime rate in Bogota also with CCTV, or rather, what is your...
Very, very, keep it a very short answer, Enrique, very short answer, because this is...
Desperate feeling that kind of if CCTV is going to be the kind of medium that we all depend on, that it won't be long before we will discover the aberration and the disadvantages of that kind of perpetual policing.
I mean, can we... Just very briefly, can you give a very short answer? I'd like to hold the issue of CCTV, which is ubiquitous in Britain, but actually welcome generally, worth understanding that. But Enrique, it's a question to you.
We have some CCTV, and it's useful basically in order to have proofs to bring to a judge. But basically it's very scarce. I think in many areas where we didn't have CCTV, there was a huge improvement. And it really has to do basically, again, with a different attitude of citizens towards themselves, towards the community, towards the state. When they feel respected, they feel part of the system.
Okay. Do you want to say anything about CCTV, Ian? Because there is, I mean, London, I think Britain has a disproportionately large amount of CCTV, but I think I'm right in saying that most neighbourhoods are quite happy to see it introduced. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's been pretty well accepted in the UK. It is a balance between human rights and solving crime. But what really sells it for me is if you look at the response to the bombings on the 7th of the 7th in London, without CCTV, we would be nowhere near getting the results that we did, you know, with that. So, just around community safety, that rather than people, I think, feeling frightened and concerned about CCTV, they feel safer when it's in place, because they've had a long time to get used to it. I don't know, but certainly in London, it's still, and you know, other parts of the UK, it seems to work.
And presumably that has something to do with the belief that it will only be used by the police for the purposes that people expect it to be used for. If you see what I mean, and not spread out and to be used for some other purpose.
I think that's absolutely right. And again, it's about getting members of the public in to see how the system's used, trying to allay concerns around that as far as we can. And part of the police consultative group certainly looks at the CCTV that we've got in Southwark and checks that it's not being abused and we're using it as we should do.
But do you have a theory why, as you said, crime is declining and the sense of insecurity is increasing? Do you think there could be a connection with the ubiquity of CCTV?
Yeah, well, again, that's always possible. I think the media in the UK doesn't help. Right. But again, if it's a good point, and if you try and build a fortress, then you know, concern will rise.
Okay. Is this a directly related point? We've got a minute. Okay. Yes.
Very, very brief, because this conference has travelled from New York to Shanghai and now to London. And then there's been reference made to Jane Jacobs. I think it is worth investigating what has happened in Asian cities. All Asian cities compared to any Western cities, or in fact Latin American cities, have very low street crime. They don't have CCTVs. What is different there? Because the streets have lots of eyes. There are vendors and hawkers on the streets. This informal sector, which is allowed to exist, sometimes by planning and often by not, by violating plans. So I think it's worth looking into that.
An encouraging plea for perhaps more informal use as a way, paradoxically, of keep getting eyes and ears on the streets. Sophie Baudijon-Gondreau from the Sorbonne is our next respondent. Sophie.
Yes, I would like to come back on this very important difference we should make between fear of crime and crime. And also add to this that it seems now we were talking before about fragments in the city and assemblage of fragments. It seems that now very often crime is going to be the linkage between fragments of populations that do not know each other, but that are equally concerned with crime. So I make a difference between fear of crime, which is a concern about the problem, and crime, which is experiencing mugging, assault, violent, bodily aggrieved arms on the street, which are what poor areas experience. So let's see this difference. And the responses are going to be very different. If you address fear of crime, you are going to have quick answers, quick solutions, like putting cameras. People, it's true, feel more secure. A visible police on the street, people will be more reassured. Maybe neighborhood watchers involvement. That's one thing. But it's not solving the causes in which you have to be efficient. And that's when I'd like to address the way the police is going to work and the goals of the police. Because it's the job of the police is submitted to a contradictory injunction. On the one hand, the police are asked to be more efficient, and they are asked to bring figures to show that they arrest the suspects and that they are bringing safety on the streets, especially here in this city after the London attacks. The job of the police is also to be the eyes and ears of the potential threats, the potential disorders that could be detected. But on the other hand, the police is also asked to be fair. In a multicultural city, the police have to be fair. And how do you do that? I mean, how can you be efficient, which means going towards groups you think might be suspects? You're not going to go towards the old ladies of 70 years old on, you know, Bond Street. But at the same time, be fair. And that implies creating, I think you are going to tell me if I am right, linkages with the populations. That is establishing trust. And I think it's very difficult. And you need time. And you need partnerships, exchanges, a common language. And maybe with the young people, more dialogue, more maybe going to their schools and explaining what the police, that the police may be different from the image they have. And I would like to know if you share these views.
Ian, can I mean, broaden this out, because this, we did touch on this particular issue in the exchange that went on earlier on about Paris and London and the police and so on. And the point, I think, there's no question that relations between the police and some elements of communities in South London were incredibly strained in the past and have changed radically and have improved in recent years. And I mean, can you say what's worked and indeed what hasn't?
I think what really has worked is consultation with the public. As Sophie said, that unless we actually get out and speak to people, and again, it's not paying lip service to consultation, it's actually taking on board what people say. But I think a really good point is young people, in that the majority of the meetings that I go to, whether they're tenants' meetings, whether they're meetings with the council, that they're probably, you know, the average age of the person there is probably in their 40s. So it's about engaging young people, particularly from difficult, hard-to-reach groups, and it's how we get that across. And it's only by having as high a level of consultation as we can. And it's a bit about changing the culture of the police as well. Again, you know, I see getting people out of cars and onto estates. Community policing is tremendous. But again, it's about getting the idea into the heads of the officers that they're there to serve the people that live and work in a borough, rather than being there for their own ends. So, yeah, I would say, 100% around consultation.
And so I'd like to ask you another question. A problem we have in France is that as soon as the police officers are sent to these areas, they ask for their transfer. And consequently, they remain one year and a half. And it's impossible to establish any partnership in that respect. How is it working here? Can you route your policemen in the neighborhood?
And Sophie, I think it's a really good point. I regularly hear in London of people who get used to working with and come to love their borough commanders, and then they're gone, either to another part of the city or another part of the country. Okay, well, there's two other points here, but Ian, please respond briefly.
Yeah, again, another very good point. What you do tend to get is a lot of community officers that stay for a long time in one area, which is tremendous. Again, particular criticism from council and some communities is that senior staff, police staff, do get moved on. I've been in Southwark for almost 3 years, and again, it's very complex, very difficult environment. And again, you need a huge amount of time in an area before you get to know what the issues are. So I think it's a good point. And again, I think we would do better by keeping, senior staff in these locations. And again, it's vibrant, it's challenging, but it's a really good place to work. And certainly from my point of view, I'd prefer to work somewhere like Southwark than one of the leafy suburbs in outer London. So from my point of view, tremendous place to work. My view would be that I would stay here as long as I could.
Okay, I'm going to come on to Roger Gutzogolovich, but there are two or three points, I think, which are directly out of this. So Job Cohen, then Guido Martinotti, and then Andy Altman. So, Job.
I'd like to tell a little bit about, especially on this point, on what we are doing in Amsterdam. We introduced 10 years ago this kind of community policing, which means that we, part of our police force is specially trained to be in all those, in one person in a small area, which makes that he or she is very well aware of everything what's happening in this area. And he or she stays there for 6 years, no less, no more. And I think that is very important in order to work on your point that on the other hand, the policeman has to fight crime. Here they are the investigators of what's happening in the area, and I think that is a very it's a necessary answer in order. Well, perhaps also in Paris and in the areas where you see that there is a difference in the way the police is working. Well, there is a good relationship between the police, especially in Amsterdam and London, and I think we have the same kind of work in this area.
Thanks for that. And Guido Martinotti?
I would like to try, at least, to answer to Kulau's very important question. In Italy, we have a debate today about what we call social construction of fear. There are many subjects, many actors, who inadvertently or not contribute to a general fear. For instance, you have expert systems. If you listen on the media about hazards in health, you become immediately afraid, you see. That's the immediate outcome, not talking about avian flu, but even minor problem, because every expert wants, to give some kind of cautious answer. I have a good example with the cholera in Naples. And cholera in Naples, somebody started giving out the idea that if you drank or ate lemons, it was good for cholera. I mean, that was not at all, but the doctors interviewed would not say this is baloney. They would say, okay, well, it's good. So immediately the price of lemon went up like mad, and there are many of these examples. The second, of course, is the press, the media. Then you have politicians. So there is a general trend toward the social construction of fear, which has different reasons but the same outcome. I read this morning on the newspaper about fountain pens, that there is now a scare about fountain pens kept, that kids could eat them. And it's very interesting because when I was a kid, I grew up in a no man's land between partisans and Germans, and we not only had pens in our school, but we had bombs. And of course, somebody got injured, and one also got killed, but there was no fear. You see, even kids were very learned about arms, but there was a big scare which was planted by the secret fascist secret police, that the Allied would drop explosive fountain pens. So it reminded me today of this idea that during my grade school I had that there were explosive fountain pens. But I think that this is a crucial issue, that we should really understand a little bit better how it comes about.
I mean, you do raise an interesting and separate issue about the evolving politics of fear, which is a much, much wider issue than this one. But there's no question that the media in Britain, and Ian did refer to this, have undoubtedly contributed to the sense of a perception of a greater problem with crime than there is. But that's not quite the same as the ramping up of ever greater fear factors for us all in order to rely on the state more, which is a separate issue, again, for a bigger conference than this. Andy Altman, you've been very patiently waiting at the back there.
Thank you. I actually want to go to a little different topic, which is to go back to Fred's, what I think Fred's challenge was, which links to the theme of the conference, which was that we must, when we look at urban regeneration or mega projects, we must deal with the social and not just the physical. I think that's what you said, Fred, and which very much is what we're trying to connect here. And I think it raises an interesting challenge for city planning, and particularly as you plan pieces of the city. So what I wanted to find out a little more about, Fred, is if you could talk about how one, when you're looking at these, like Elephant and Castle or other pieces of the city that we're going to look at in the next 2 days, what does that actually mean? Are you talking about the social implications of the physical intervention, or are you saying that it's actually a broader approach, that one must look at deeper issues of the social welfare of the neighborhood, the schools in the neighborhood? And you know, given that planning in many ways has retreated from comprehensiveness, right, because by trying to solve everything, we solve nothing, how does one, given the limitations both of boundaries and where different these problems are dealt with at different levels of government, how does one really do planning effectively to deal with both the physical and the social, and what does your experience of Southwark tell us about that?
Yep, you go, and then we'll come back to the next two respondents after this answer.
It's a big issue. I think the point I was really trying to make is that when the link was made between poverty and jobs, what the local authority and others have to do is to focus on jobs. And you don't necessarily have to do physical regeneration to get that right. We also made an argument, which I didn't go into today, that if you improve the schools in an area, people would want to move into that area. This was another one that got incredibly contentious, that it was actually gentrifying an area by improving the schools. I pointed out that, in fact, good education is one of the essential elements for everyone in an area. It doesn't need regeneration. It doesn't need any physical change to make those things happen. And I think there's a terrible temptation to say, oh, I can't deal with that issue because I'm waiting for the physical change to happen. I will go, just for the final bit, go back to Peckham. Peckham spent something like £300 million improving the housing, building a new library and a few other things in the area. The major difference between before and after is before it, almost everyone wanted to leave, and after it, more than 70% of the people wanted to stay. So we spent hundreds of millions of pounds to get people to be committed to their area. Is that efficient or not? I don't know.
Okay. Thank you for that, Fred. Now, Roger Zagolovich from AZ Urban Studio London, one of our last two remaining respondents. Roger.
I think I want to really pick up on Fred's point of the timeline that he was describing. And I think today we've seen examples of development at a scale which is very significant. So we're actually looking at, and this conference is examining, these large holes in the makeup of London and the mechanism and the process by which they get redeveloped. And that process of redevelopment is the combination of the investment of capital and the combination of the usage of the social fabric that goes on to make the program that makes that development work. And I agree with a lot of what Frank has said, that there is this huge difficulty, and in a sense this conversation is fascinating, because what Fred described and what I know as a developer in Southwark was that he used a sort of system of artifice to raise the game of North Southwark. And so whereas maybe I think he's being very he I think single-mindedly changed the position or thinking of the borough to allow the possible development on the north side. So when the Tate came, it came a beacon which transformed investors' minds as to what was possible. The issue really that that I'm in a sense trying to sort of tease out is, at one level, when we take those elements, each of those elements are made up of buildings. And what is so extraordinary now about North Southwark is that there are huge examples of those buildings which lead that regeneration. Fred's point about Peckham is there is a single building which actually sits there and has made an extraordinary contribution. So in a sense, what I'm saying is we talk about these buildings, and we now have discussions in the industry about high-rise buildings, about towers, but actually when we hear about the issues of crime and the issues of the social feeling of comfort, are we not actually forgetting that the building itself needs to have its place in the city, its place and its kind of comfort level? Are we forgetting that actually these programs are made up of a series of smaller buildings? And in a sense, what I'm concerned about is, have we put ourselves into a process where so much money, so much investment, projects are so large that they're impossible of achieving in anything but a complete big bang approach? When in reality, actually, what we're looking for is a process of regeneration or a process of projects which actually can unlock or unravel over much shorter time periods. How is it possible for us to look at Elephant and Castle and to pick it off piece by piece? How is it possible for us to look at White City? I at one stage even owned a small part of that White City site, and I called it Radio City, and I even have a video of the beauty of the underside of that elevated motorway. And the kind of soundtrack that went along with it. How is it that we are able to kind of retrack these bits of the city? How can we find the mechanism which actually just slowly engages or allows us to immediately engage with something? What is it? Is it festival? Is it street theatre? Is it single buildings? Do we have a kind of process where this big scale of project is actually a self-defeating process?
Am I right in thinking, Roger, when you referred to the single building in Peckham, you meant the library?
Indeed, yeah.
Just say a word or two for those who don't know about the library, especially as it wasn't one of yours, as it were. Say something about it, just to fill that out a bit.
Well, there was a competition, and I think it was part of a lottery project and a series of lottery projects, and it was won by Will Alsop. And it acts as a beacon. It actually, what is extraordinarily successful about it is it has changed, in a sense, similar to the way in which David's project changed, which we were all in Whitechapel. It's changed the way in which people feel there is no barrier to entering this library, and it has a kind of it's become a territory where children in that neighbourhood feel they can come in and do their homework, where children in that neighbourhood feel that they can actually once again feel proud about actually getting some kind of attainment, and therefore through that attainment then actually gaining their own onward progression through the employment. And in a sense, I think that a lot of what we're seeing, and particularly where we hear about eyes on the street and all of these aspects, somehow it's a very small element of something like that which actually has a huge consequence of alteration to the environment.
I think it's fair to say that David's library, where we're in Whitechapel, where we were last night, has a similar function in an equally challenged urban environment. Finally, last but not least, of course, Julia Thrift, who is the director of CABE Space, is our last but not least respondent, Julia.
I'd like to bring the conversation back to the elephant and castle. I would argue very strongly that, if you look at the title of this, it's about the future of public life in South London. But look on the map, the elephant is central London. It really is. It's right slap bang in the middle of London. But it doesn't feel like that to Londoners. It doesn't feel like a central place. And I think that's partly because it's a place that you rush to pass through unless you happen to live there or work there. It's somewhere you drive through, it's somewhere you go through on the tube, it's somewhere you're trying often to get out of. And Fred's picture makes it look a lot greener and more pleasant than it sometimes does. If you go there on a wet Tuesday in February, you won't get that impression at all. And I would argue that good public space is space that you want to linger in, that you stay in. And if you think about the spaces, the great world squares, the places you visited that you enjoy, they're places that you slow down and you stop, you have a look around, you chat, whatever. So thinking about what is a good public space, firstly, it might be somewhere that you want to stay in rather than get out of. And secondly, I'd argue that it's a space that's used by everyone. A public space is used by all of the public, and that's not all of us in this room. We're a very self-selecting audience here. It's a lot of people who aren't in this room as well. And there are huge benefits to that sort of successful public space, benefits in terms of social cohesion, in terms of public health, people walking around getting exercise on the way to do something else, economic benefits, and so on. There are also benefits of reducing the fear of crime, as we've heard earlier on. Having lots of different people in a space makes you feel safer. And if the big problem is fear of crime, which in many places it is, feeling safe is hugely important. And often seeing vulnerable people in a space, mums with kids, people in wheelchairs, adds to that sense that it's a safe place to be. So having everybody using a space is a really important factor. Cade Space has done some research which shows some fairly clear links between the quality of the design of the space, which we've been discussing today, but also the quality of the management and the way it's maintained. And I think those things are very important. It's not just design, it's also management and maintenance. But in the UK, for various reasons, there are, I think, two things that stop good design, good management, and good maintenance happening. The first one is that public space is often added in after the buildings, as it were, and very often the budget for the buildings runs over and therefore the budget for the space is squeezed, and you end up with spaces that were perhaps well designed in the first place but are poorly implemented. The classic example is going to a public space and there are no seats there. Why can't you sit down? Because the money ran out before the benches were put in. They were the last thing. So That's one reason why often good designs don't end up being good public spaces. Another one is that due to the way that public space is funded in this country, local authorities struggle to maintain them. There are all sorts of discussions around that, but the reality is it's very difficult to find the money sometimes to do the quality of maintenance that a good public space deserves. And I think it's worth reflecting that spaces aren't like buildings. A building that's fantastic on a Monday is going to be fantastic on Friday. A good public space that's fantastic on Monday could be completely trashed by Friday if people are using it. And the maintenance is really important. And we do have some fantastic new spaces in Britain. If you go up to Manchester, for instance, you'll see some. But they're not as good as they were when they were designed. And that's because huge arguments around that. But the maintenance isn't what it could have been, which is, I think, very sad. One way out of the problem, and one that many enlightened developers are now thinking about, is they don't want to hand over high-quality space to local authorities because they know that with the best will in the world, the local authority will struggle to maintain it. So developers are often now thinking about looking after spaces themselves. You then end up with a problem, and you can see it with the little signs outside that say no skateboarding and no this, that and the other, that the space isn't exactly there for everybody. You start to exclude people very often, or people feel excluded. And so I think there's a big tension there between ensuring the quality of maintenance and not excluding people who might want to use that space. Finally, I just want, again, to come back to the elephant. The elephant was last regenerated in a big way in the 60s, but the planning for that took place in the 1950s. One of the planners who was working on that project, and I would agree with Fred from the little I know of it, they weren't malicious people, they were trying to make London better. And one of them said, people will come here to watch the traffic. And I think you can sort of think your way back into the 50s and see where they might have been coming from. But if you go to the Elephant now, the reason you want to leave is the traffic. The traffic dominates the place. That statement is now risible. We can all laugh at it. But we still haven't got away from putting traffic first and pedestrians second. Certainly not in this country. It's happening elsewhere. And until we do that, we're not going to have places that people want to linger in. And we're not going to have places that are truly successful public spaces.
Okay, thanks, Julia. We've got about 7 or 8 minutes, in fact, if we're going to finish at 6:15. Julia's raised the question, this place, the Elephant and Castle, if you draw a line from Tate Modern to Tate Britain, it actually passes through the Elephant and Castle, straight line. I mean, it's differently located to the way Londoners think of it. It's in Zone 1 on the underground and so on. And the question of how it can be built into the way central London works, I think, is an interesting one. And then the other issue is an issue that Richard Sennett touched on and that earlier on, and that's how far can a recreated area of convergence and public use be arranged towards more civil and enjoyable street-level activities? I mean, starting from scratch with all the risks that people who are not malicious can get it wrong again. So we have 7 minutes for more general contributions. Patricia Brown from the Central London Partnership. Put the microphone on in front of you to speak.
Done. Thank you. Thanks, Tony. Picking up on Julia's point, as you said, Tony, you talked about initially as the river of the barrier, and that keeps coming up in the discussion today. And I think the river has got a tremendous role to play as being the villain of the piece for why people don't think of Elephant and Castle as being part of central London. It really skews perception. And I think it's more than most people's mental maps can cope with, actually thinking about where Elephant is in London. If you look at the A to Z, you've just referenced the line from Tate Modern to Tate Millbank. It's actually, I'd say, not south of the river, it's east of the river. And you, if you draw a line, as I have done, when we recently had an event on the Elephant and Castle, I looked at the precise coordinates. And you actually can go from on the same coordinates on the east to west to Victoria, and north to south, it's on the same coordinates as Smithfield. And nobody would actually think of those two areas as being not in central London. So the river has really sort of got a large part of play in not putting it in the right place in people's heads. I think the tube map has also helped that. But it's also the other issue of severance, and we've talked about barriers in general. In the past, I think the severance of activity between the activity of the South Bank and what's going on around Bankside and Waterloo and what's happening on the Elephant and Castle, the distance that people have to walk, although not actually dramatic, is filled with, for the most part, a bit of a no man's land. If you walked from Covent Garden to St. Paul's, it's precisely the same distance from walking from St. Paul's to Elephant and Castle. But because you've got this thing called Holborn in the middle of Covent Garden and the city, you actually feel as though it's still part of central London. And with that comes the issue of dead frontages. At night, that area is really grotty to walk through, or there's just nothing happening that makes you feel safe. When you leave Ian's police station on Borough High Street and walk to the Elephant and Castle, there's absolutely very little activity there, both in the day, besides cars, and of the night. And I think it's all of those things which make people feel as though they're falling off the edge of the world.
Thanks, Patricia. It is incredibly dead, and certainly there is a dead zone between the Elephant and Castle and the rest of central London. Sorry? You, Ricky.
No, wind up.
Oh, and I was going to say one more thing before I will wind up. It's interesting that the debate about the Elephant and Castle has, understandably, and was designed to centre on the issue of security and the way in which what is to Londoners a rather alien environment, a place that is indeed synonymous with the unpleasant things of living in cities, concrete, traffic and so on, is still loved by the people who live in it. And in some way, some of the efforts to regenerate it and move people away from it while it is regenerated run into the problem that people who live there don't hate it as much as people might imagine they would. People are quite loyal to it. I think what's also interesting about this particular debate is that this afternoon is that it has brought together the question of security, design, regeneration, and touched on transport. And it is difficult to bolt these things together for very long. And I suspect that in part explains why the redevelopment of the Elephant and Castle is so very difficult and takes so very long. Anyway, that is the end of this session. I have a couple of final announcements to make, one of which is to thank Miguel Canay, Sarah Ikiota for their briefings on the two projects that we've considered this afternoon. They have been excellent. And while pulling together details and information about them isn't quite as difficult as delivering them, it is difficult, so thank you both for that. And then the final notice is that there will be a bus from as near to buses can get to this building, which isn't very close, but somebody will know where, at 6:30 from Tooley Street, which is in fact, it's no use doing that, Ricky. Nobody knows where we are, but it's somewhere over here. It's impossible to work out where we are. Sorry, it's Tooley Street. Anyway, somebody will lead a group, I hope, through Potter's Fields. This is going to take all those who are going, it's going to be a big bus, judging by the show of hands earlier, to Wapping for drink and food. So thank you all very much for joining in. Thank you, particularly in this swelteringly hot room with no windows. So thank you all for staying. See you tomorrow morning.